This is Sally Novette. You are listening to the Sirens of Audio.
Oh, yes, quite so. Yes, of course, I do know the medium.
G'day audiophiles, you're listening to the Sirens of Audio, the podcast that explores the worlds of Doctor Who, and today we're going to look at Blake 7-2 in the audio medium. My name is Dwayne.
And my name is Philip. G'day Dwayne, g'day audiophiles.
Well, g'day Philip. Today's a good one. We're going to be speaking with Jan Chappell later on in the episode, and I hear that Jan may have been a little bit of a crush for you.
Yes, Jan was a bit of a crush when I was young, and...
Oh, should we say was, or...?
Oh, she's still a bit of a crush too. Amazing person, and yeah, still beautiful, still charming. And I was devastated when they killed her. It was one of the worst moments of my childhood.
Yeah, it was pretty surprising for me too when I first saw those episodes on the television. But she's definitely back, most recently in The Clone Masters, a release in the Worlds of Blake 7 range. And yeah, be interested to hear our listener and well, our audience feedback. So drop a comment if you're watching on YouTube, send us an email or drop a line on our socials if you're listening to us. Let us know what you think of the Clone Masters and what you think of the Worlds of Blake 7 in general. We've had a few releases out now, and there's more to come. Very exciting stuff. But before we have a chat with Jan, do you know what I see, Philip?
Is it something large and dark?
Yes, it is very large and very dark. It's a rabbit hole. Here we go. Meep, meep. Okay, Philip, today I want to talk about something that's kind of audio and kind of not audio. Can you guess what I'm going to talk about? No, you can't. I want to talk about the animations, because at the time of recording, we've got a recent announcement that Galaxy 4 is coming out, made by Big Finish. The animation's been done by Big Finish Creative. Is that what it's called? Big Finish Creative or Big Finish Studios? No, Big Finish Creative, I think it is. And I think Jason Hagelery was talking about this as a big surprise that was just about to hit us when we were talking to him. And as usual, 2 days after we talk to someone, the announcement comes out of what it was. So thank you, Jason, for the hint. But this is what he was talking about. So I want to talk to you about how you felt about the missing episodes. Did you get all the missing episodes and listen to them on audio CD like I did when they were first released?
Yes, certainly. The audio CDs recordings, the first ones I got was actually tape recordings.
Right.
So Tom Baker did some narrations. I think Tom Baker did, I think it was Tomb of the Cybermen. And
he did Fury from the Deep too.
And Fury from the Deep. And then John Pertwee.
I think it was Pertwee on Tomb of the Cybermen. And Tom Baker was, oh no, that was Colin Baker did Macra Terror. You could be right on Tomb of the Cybermen.
So anyhow, I've got them sitting in my cupboard just over there. I could go look at them, but I didn't know what you were going to talk about, so I had no time to prepare. Otherwise, I would have had a look and
seen.
That's
the point. I don't want you to prepare.
Yeah. So my original listening to those missing episodes was on tape in my CD Walkman. And I actually remember Sydney Uni Gym listening to some of them when I first bought them from the ABC shop from Queen Victoria Building in Sydney. So I remember buying them and listening to them. When the BBC released the CD versions, though, with the narrations from the cast members of the time, they were a major step up.
And they were very heavily cleaned up by Mark Ayres as well.
Yeah, they sounded, yes, the tapes weren't...
They were awful.
They really were. So I remember listening to them and just being enthralled. I used to get out my Doctor Who magazines with the, what are the little photos called? The John Cure telesnaps?
Yes.
and I'd listen to the audio and I'd look at the telly snaps as we were going with the because I think Doctor Who magazine released an episode a month of different shows, and so I had them all collected. And yeah, I remember that's how I experienced those early episodes the first time.
Okay, did you get your hands on copies of the Recons, the loose cannon ones, for instance? They were pretty big back in the day.
Yeah, I've certainly seen some of them. I was never as impressed by the Recons. For me, I'd rather just hear it and imagine it. I think that the Target books had played a major input in terms of visually what I was expecting to see. And the Recons never quite did it justice. And seeing the same photo used over and over and over again, I just got a bit bored with that. It just wasn't quite snappy enough for me. Whereas just the audio works, which I don't know why. I mean, so I think there would have been some of the first audio I would have listened to would have been the Recons before they'd actually released them all with the BBC, because they didn't all come out straight away. And so some of the Recons was the first time I did get to experience those early shows. But it was always the audios were always more important for me.
Okay. And now that the animations have started coming out, there's probably more stories now animated than not animated, or to complete the series, at least have to be at least half of them by now. What's your impression been of the animations? Has that made the experience of watching the episodes more enjoyable for you? I hear some people say no, they would rather just watch telly snaps with the audio over the top. Some people would say they just rather hear the audio. And some people, I mean, there's always people criticizing something somewhere, but there is some criticism of the animations. But what about you personally?
I still have at least two, maybe three DVDs in their plastic wraps still from the animations.
Right.
So I haven't even bothered to take them out and watch them. I bought them because I just have to buy everything because I'm that sort of sad person. I've not been particularly impressed by any animations, and maybe the ones I haven't watched are really worth watching, and maybe that's the problem. I haven't watched the best ones yet. Part of it was, I think, it just changed style so much. I think the first ones to be animated, I think, was The Invasion. Mm-hmm. And certainly, I guess I was kind of glad to see those animations, but they weren't well done. And I guess I'm so used to seeing such great animation done. And even stuff that's
what is it that you're unhappy with? Because The Invasion in particular, that's one that stands out for me as being one of my personal favourites. I think it's fantastic.
I guess I'm a believer that if it's an art form, you should let the art form rule. And maybe the animations try too hard to reduplicate what the episodes and the characters look like, as opposed to just let go and not worry about it. Because they're not going to look right because it's animations. And so when you try too hard to make it look right, it ends up failing. So for me, I'd rather go for something stylized and, you know, just a style. I just don't feel any animation. And they've all been slightly different styles because it keeps being handed around to different people. I haven't found one that I think this is a style of animation that I like to watch. And I like animation. And, you know, just finishing the grand tour of Star Wars with my 11-year-old, where we've watched every single piece of Star Wars media that's been produced from beginning to end, every movie, every spin-off show, every etc. And of course, yeah, we watch all the Clone Wars, all of Rebels, and it's not that animation doesn't try and be realistic, but it works. And I actually cried in animations, which I've never done before, but there's episodes in Rebels and towards the end of Clone Wars, where I was emotionally just stirred by these characters who don't really look like the characters, but they're not trying to. So I'm not sure if it's a Doctor Who tries too hard to try and make it look like the character and you just lose the belief. But for me, I think Clone Wars and Rebels, both different styles, but they found their style, they were happy and they stuck with it. I haven't found yet a Doctor Who show that, to me, feels like it's found the style that marries character and background properly, that marries the sound properly with the animation. So to me, the whole package hasn't been credited yet. Okay. What about you? What do you think? You're obviously a bit more happy.
Well, I wouldn't say I'm more happy. I'm probably a bit less critical. Although I'm unsure why there are so many different styles, why they haven't picked one and just stuck with it. That's been a little bit confusing for me, particularly Power of the Daleks. How many different formats has that been released in? Many, many different formats. Then they did the special edition release most recently for Power of the Daleks. And I'm one who enjoys actually watching these animations in color. There are a lot of people who refuse to watch them in color, but I kind of find myself never watching them in black and white, to be honest. I don't know why that is. I guess I'm just personally drawn to it. Probably the worst animation that I can think of off the top of my head would have to be those two episodes from the Ice Warriors. That was quite poor when it came to the overall enjoyment of those two episodes, but that was one of
Not
the early
watch them.
ones.
I've not seen them.
Right. Yeah,
So,
you'll know what I mean if you ever do.
yeah, no, probably
I
not.
think it's worth, I definitely think it's worth watching. Definitely the invasion stands out for me as being some of the best. And what I found interesting that I had the cassettes too. So with Furu from the Deep and Macra were two episodes in particular where the sound quality on the cassettes was really bad. So I never really got into Fury from the Deep. I tried to get it, I tried to like it, but the sound quality was just too bad on those cassettes. Macra Terra was the same. That was in some ways even worse. But what I found is that certain episodes that I was re really enjoyed, the existing episodes that they have, like the Faceless ones, for instance, when I eventually saw the animation, because they don't just animate the non-existent episodes, they'll animate all of the things. When I went and watched the Faceless ones, I didn't enjoy it as much as listening to the audio and just having those two existent episodes. Whereas the Macra Terra, an episode which I didn't like very much previously on audio only, it's probably my favorite animation as a complete story that had to be animated. That's probably my favorite one, Macra Terra, and I absolutely love the story. They've tweaked it, they've done a few things to it, they've cut out a couple of scenes here and there, they've extended some scenes here and there. Fury from the Deep was very good too. I've seen criticism for Fury from the Deep, but I don't quite like. There's the additions that they've made to Fury from the Deep.
What do you mean by additions?
At the end, in episode six, there's a scene with the helicopter. The doctor is in the helicopter flying around the oil rig, and they've added these giant seaweed tentacles coming up out of the water, reaching up towards the helicopter. And I thought that wouldn't have definitely happened. And I heard Gary Russell say something along the lines of, in the TV series, it was more played for laughs, but in the animation, they tried to make it more for threat. And for drama rather than for laughs. And I think he was right. I think that worked really well. One thing, have you seen Fury from the Deep?
The animation, no.
Yeah.
I've got it.
One thing that did confuse me about Fury from the Deep was their choice to change that scene, that non-existent or that cut scene that was found in Australia with Mr. Oak and Mr. Quill blowing the gas. One of the most frightening scenes in the history of Doctor Who, and they've gone and changed it in the animation, and it kind of diminishes the fear factor of it. I don't understand. They've changed the camera angles. They don't flash from face to face. It's they've com if there was one criticism I have of Fury from the Deep, it would be that they've kind of changed that scene too much.
See, maybe that's my issue with the animations, is there's no possible way they could have captured what the show is. They don't know what the scenes were like. They don't know what the cuts were like. They don't
Yeah,
know the
but they could
camera
have captured
angles.
that scene.
Well,
Is
exactly.
that?
And so we know that they haven't. And so you've just pointed out the fact that they didn't even bother with the scenes they've got to recapture that what it was supposed to be there. So they decided to go their own way. And for me, that's not a missing episode. I don't know what it is, but it's not Doctor Who. It's not what the episode was. It's not a recreation of the episode because it's some sort of, I don't know, cheap thing. So to me, I'd rather not watch the animations because they're not, the shows are better. I believe the shows are better. I mean, there was certainly when Web of Fear came out and Enemy of the World, Enemy of the World surpassed my wildest dreams and how good it was.
Yep.
And then the opening scene when they come out of the TARDIS and the Doctor runs into the ocean and he does his little cap in the air in his long johns. There's no possible way we could have known that's what was going on in that scene. They couldn't animate it. Who knows what they would have done with animation. And that is so magic. And that is the beauty and brilliance of Patrick Troughton. And his quirkiness and his performance is what makes him. The animation can't capture any of that. So I'd rather not have it. I'd rather just hear the dialogue and hear the story and see pictures if some pictures exist. But an animation, that's actually, to me, degrading what was done in the performance.
You'd rather not have it, but you've bought it anyway.
Well, that's because I'm a completist.
Have you seen the Macra Terror?
Can I say I don't buy them till they're under $10. So yeah, it's 12, yeah. So JB Hi-Fi, I wait till they're on sale and two for one and super cheap. That's gotcha. When I buy them, and I still don't open them. But I have to have the complete set because I'm a Doctor Who fan. It's what we do. Now, what were you asking about Macra Terror?
Have you seen it?
No.
Can I give you some homework then?
Yes, okay.
Can I recommend that you watch the Macra Terror in color? It is very, very enjoyable. The sound's been cleaned up even more than the CD, and I think that's probably the best animation out there at the moment. I am excited about Galaxy 4 coming up as well, because that's a great story. Something from season 3 that we desperately need. It's the worst represented season of Classic Who. We definitely need more from season 3. If you don't do anything, if you don't watch any others, just watch Macra Terror. It's only 4 episodes. You'll be right. You'll get through it. Between all your Big Finish listening.
Yeah, I'll do that.
All right, let's get out of this rabbit hole and let's throw in a trailer for The Clone Masters, and then we'll be back in a moment with our chat with Jan Chappell from Blake 7.
Oh, what is it? There's no one on reception because reception's been smashed to pieces.
From Big Finish Productions, the worlds of Blake 7. The Clone Masters.
Jenna Stannis.
Hello, Hinton.
How wonderful to see you again. You've barely changed. I'm under commission from a Clone Master.
A Clone Master?
Their ruler has died.
Sound the bells. The Queen of the Clone Masters is dead.
There's quite the power struggle underway on their homeworld. If I can help them ascend to the throne, the Resistance might have a powerful new friend.
Stop all this! Stop all this at once!
Travis, I didn't think we would make quite so dramatic an entrance.
It's you! No! No! Keep back!
This is a research base that specialized in cloning.
She thought she recognized you. She called you Lara.
It cannot be a coincidence that there is some sort of connection to both the Clone Masters and the Aurons.
Commander Travis, I am currently with a patient.
You know who I am.
Of course I do. Travis, Space Commander, Alpha 15105.
You shouldn't have come here. It's not safe.
We must make a hasty exit. Come on!
Dr. Sim! Okay, that does it.
I believe I'd make a worthy commanding officer.
Do you really?
I am Space Commander Travis. I am destined for great things.
Goodbye, Kevin. What are you doing?
You have an Auron in your crew, don't you? Callie.
Why are you asking?
Because I came across an unusual Auron myself. Alara Kay.
Big Finish. We love stories.
It's my great pleasure to welcome to the Sirens of Audio, Jan Chappell. Thanks for joining us, Jan.
Lovely to be here, as it were, in communication with you.
It's great how that we can do that these days, isn't it?
No, it's astonishing. I think it's a miracle. I've been really nervous thinking my lack of technological equipment is very basic, that somehow it wouldn't happen. I wouldn't get through to you and we'd all be in a mess.
So to start us off, can you tell us a little bit about your childhood and what made you want to become an actress?
Well, do you know, when I saw that this was probably one of the questions you were likely to ask me, I thought about it and I remembered the very first time I played a role. And what had happened was I'd suffered some terrible injustice. My parents had done something that made me so angry with them. And at the time, I was terrified of this book, which was about witches. And it was all dark blue and dark green and black lined drawings of these witches. And one was called Mrs. Longtooth. And the only thing on the page that was white was her teeth. And as a sort of 5-6-year-old, I must have been, it really frightened me. Well, on this occasion, I remember I went to my room in absolute fury. I suddenly took it in my head that I was going to go in there and sort of bare my teeth at them and be Mrs. Longtooth in my fury, which is what I did. I think I threw something like a dressing gown around my shoulders and went in and sort of growled and leered at them and then rushed right out. I have no idea what their reaction was, but I didn't stay to see it. But I thought that's actually the first role I played was Mrs. Longtooth being angry. But I guess it's always been something, a way of expressing how you feel. And quite often growing up, sometimes I was told I was not nervous. No, you do want to do this and you are not nervous. So in the end, I suppose I was told I wasn't feeling what I was feeling. And so suddenly actually meant you could express how you were feeling in a very proper way. And after that, I was good at reading at school in my infant school. And then I played Alice in Wonderland and Alice Through the Looking Glass at my Methodist Church Hall. Then as time went by in my secondary school, I was asked to play the leading parts. You know, at 14, I was playing Viola in Twelfth Night, the Shakespeare play. And then in our school competitions, they'd say, well, Janice, you're the best actress. You can either direct it or act in it. And actually, I chose to direct. And I think in a later time, I probably would have chosen to be a director rather than an actor, because when things weren't going well in a production, I used to feel it very deeply. I used to think, oh, no, it should be like this or it should be like that. And then I joined the National Youth Theatre, where I met Helen Mirren, Ian McShane, Martin Jarvis. I don't know if these names mean a lot to you. We had a great fun. I think there was, at the time I joined, we first worked in the admin. There were 5 girls and about 90 boys. And my mother left me in London, age 16, to work for the National Youth Theatre. And she apparently had a terrible time on holiday and couldn't understand why I wouldn't go on holiday with them. And I had to check in with my auntie Connie each night I got back to South London, having been working in the West End in Soho, popping into the pubs to get the boys a drink, you know, after the show or whatever. And dressing Ian McShane and Simon Ward and Martin Jarvis and coping with all sorts of well, to my mind, relatively innocent harassment, which now would be so frowned on, pats on the bum and whatever. But, you know, we were made of strong stuff, us girls. Anyway, and then I started doing grade examinations, being taught grade examinations for Guildhall. And at round about 12, I decided what I really wanted to do. At 11, I desperately wanted to be a vet. That was the one thing I wanted to be, was a vet, until I saw a dog with stitches in its side walking under the bridge in Herne Hill near Brixton. I thought, I couldn't possibly be a vet. And after that, I wanted to be an actress. It was the Youth Junior Drama League was something I joined, then the Youth Theatre, then Amateur Drama, and then applied for RADA.
I wanted to pick up on Martin Jarvis, who you mentioned. We do know him very well as Doctor Who fans. He's been in Doctor Who quite a number of times. He first appeared in 1965, I think, was it, Philip? Yep. And a couple of times with John Pertwee and then with Colin Baker as well. So
he was the first one I fell in love with at 16. He was 21. He was my first love. Really?
Was he really?
Yes.
How did you first come to meet Stephen Greif?
Well, I met him because he was a couple of terms below me at RADA. I arrived in the autumn of 63, and I think he must have arrived at the beginning or the spring of the following year, something like that. But I didn't know him then so well, except that he went out with the girl whose flat I was sharing. I don't know if you heard this story. Jane Bond, an actress in my group, was going, I don't know how she connected with Stephen Greif, but one can't imagine. But we used to see him around in our flat in Shepherd's Bush. And that's how I first met him.
Okay, what was your impression of Stephen at the time?
Well, he was quite a, how shall I say, he had a lot of gravitas as he has now. So I suppose he was a little, not intimidating, but I didn't know him really. You know what I mean? He was sort of there, very tall, very handsome, with his wonderful voice. Yeah, a bit intimidating, I guess.
What was studying at RADA like for you?
Well, I was quite an innocent, just turned 18. In fact, I'd applied the year before and I hadn't got there. And of course, I wanted to go to the one place where Martin Jarvis had been. And I saw him in a finals production and I spotted him and John Hurt. I picked out John Hurt was playing a soldier. Martin was playing Domitian, the Roman general or something. And that's why I went to see it, of course. I was quite young and I tried for RADA the year before and I hadn't got in and I just went to bed weeping. And it was the same day I had an audition for Central School and I didn't even get to that audition because I so wanted to go to RADA. And it was like we were encouraged to think we'd joined the profession, joining RADA, really. And it was rather like that. I don't think it was, its ethos wasn't as much as a training as I think it should have been, because if you were good at things, you remained good at things. It was not like the people who were less proficient were encouraged more. They weren't. They were given the lesser parts. You know what I mean? And I didn't, looking back as a teacher, I don't think it was a great training. I mean, not in that sense, but I think their technical training was brilliant. Voice was excellent. And movement was excellent. There was some other dubious stuff. We had we learnt how to smoke cigarettes going, which you wouldn't do now. We'd practice, do this. What? You know, how to use a cigarette technically, which is just
very important skill. Very important skill.
But they were actors coming in from the outside with their own little ideas, I think, which weren't always great. You had to use your intelligence to pick up what you wanted to use and what you were going to reject. That's what I think.
Now we did some research and we believe you won the Jenny Laird Award in drama school for what was... Is that incorrect?
I did win the Jenny Laird thing, but I had no inkling that it was for a thankless part. It was like there was a top award, and one of the terms there was a top award, the next award, and this was either the fourth or the fifth, Jenny Laird. So it's fourth. There was a group of about 6-7 prizes, and Jenny Laird was on it. And you must add that the following term, I won the top award, the Kendall, which Stephen Greif won as well. So our names are still on the board in Gower Street at the Royal Academy. I'd rather you'd ask me about that than Jenny Laird. I have no idea what that it was for a thankless part is the first I ever heard. And the £5, I don't think I ever got. I looked up and it said something about winning a £5 note. You must have looked at that. You found that then.
Yes, I found that. Part of my research.
Extraordinary. I swear I didn't get the £5 note. I think I ought to go back and ask for it.
Yes, I did also see that you'd won the Kendall Award, but I couldn't actually find anywhere. I tried to track down what the Kendall Award was and even who it was named after, and I wasn't able to do that. So that's why I didn't ask about that.
Oh, I see. Well, the Kendall, I've forgotten one of the, it was an actor, Kendall. I don't even remember what it was. It was a book. It was a book and it was the top award for that term. It was like the equivalent, the gold, the silver and the Kendall were each, because we were termly intakes. It wasn't yearly intakes. We'd taken each term. So you got your top prize for your term. So it was equivalent to the gold medal or the silver, the Kendall. You know, that's why this board reflected that. That's why I love having my name under Ian Holm and Glenda Jackson.
So what did you do between RADA and getting the role of Kelly on Blake 7?
Well, I was doing a lot of theatre. I started out at lovely theatre in Guildford, playing with a quite noted actress called Heather Sears at the time. It was a great job to start off with. And then I moved on to the Royal Court, which I'm always very proud to have been part of that as one of our top theatres of new writing. And after that, because we were trained to think, well, we were, it was like a, there was a progression, an expectation that after that, well, I was lucky, it was like starting quite far up the round, but we were always encouraged, you need to do your apprenticeship in rep. So I then went into rep in Salisbury. I'd been very successful in my finals playing St. Joan and wonderful national reviews and things. And I guessed, obviously, on the back of that, I was asked to play St. Joan again at Salisbury Playhouse. So then I went back in to do rep work and worked at various repertory companies. And I think my first television actually did come from a Royal Court job. Which was in a Somerset Maugham play with Maggie Smith and Robert Stevens. I played Maggie Smith's maid servant. And then that started me, because it was always so difficult to get your first telly. And in those days, you had to do so many weeks of theatre before you were given the licence, as it were, to accept a television job.
Okay, so how did the part of Kelly come about? How did you first get that?
Oh, well, that was appearing at the Royal Court, because I appeared there several times. That was in a play that, again, David Jackson was in. And David Maloney came to see that. And as a result of that, I didn't know at the time, that was why we were both called in, because he was casting Blake 7.
So how did he ask you to come and audition? Did he just ask you to take the role?
We were asked to come in for an interview. I can't actually remember reading it. I must have done. I'm sure we did. And I remember sitting outside a room. I think it was probably the second time I went in. I think I went twice. And that was when I first met Paul Darrow, who was sitting beside me, and said to me, rubbed his hands and said, "This would be rather good, wouldn't it?" I said, "Oh, yes, it would be rather good." But I forgot, I wanted to tell you, did you know the story where I first met Michael Keating?
No.
Well, when I was telling you about the early years, when I was doing all the drama I could once I decided I wanted to be an actress, and my parents were, we earned very little money. We lived in a very lowly part of London, South London, working class area of South London. But Mum and Dad, they were very good. They managed to find the money to pay for, remember, it's just after the war, you know, and it was all quite hard. Life was hard. We lived in a rented maisonette. They managed to raise the money to pay for trumpet lessons for my brother. And I joined a group on a Saturday morning at the Guildhall School of Music and Drama, a class for kids from, you know, 12 up to 18. And that's where I first met Michael Keating, because I can remember Michael Keating vividly in grey short flannel trousers. It's extraordinary, isn't it? Like, all that time back, that was when I first met Michael.
Can you just give me a bit more detail about, you know, getting the part? You were auditioning with Paul or outside with Paul. What did they tell you about the role? What were you expecting? Was it?
I remember there was a great emphasis on the fact that they thought this would be very popular and will we be prepared for that? And in those days, there was quite a different attitude towards series. And I'd done sort of posh end bit of, you know, the theatre, the Royal Court, had already done a little bit of RSC. I'd done one-off plays, which were, everyone wanted to do new one-off plays. And to accept a series was a bit of a step down. Yeah, wouldn't be considered that now. And I think it was reflecting the kind of writing with the new plays, the half-hour theatre, the Saturday night theatre. I think it was the quality of the writers really was what it was about. Whereas the series, they thought, oh, well, you know, it's like the soap opera series. And so, yes, I mean, to be honest, if I hadn't had the pressure of suddenly finding myself wanting to be a mother and having my son, whom I was basically raising alone, I probably would have found it hard to go, oh, should I do a series? It's just a bit, what's this series? You know, but in the circumstances, it was an absolute godsend. I was always looked after by God.
Okay. So you didn't mention the child. So you actually had a son. And so part of the reason for working in studio was...
When I started working, when I was doing the royal court job, he was 5 months, 5 months old. And I used to be able to take him into the theatre with me. And Max Wall, who's a famous comedian of great note in the country, used to sort of make a fuss of him. And John Thor was also in that cast. And they used to entertain him for the 2 hours I went in for a hustle. And then I used to pick him up, you know, back on the tube, you know, one thing and another, and take him back home. And that was the production that David saw. And I'd already turned that part down at the court twice. And the director kept coming back. So there's no way she'd consider it, because actually I'd been pregnant while I was working upstairs in the theatre upstairs at the Royal Court. And in the end, I said, well, yeah, if I can bring him with me. And they said, yes. I mean, we're talking 1977. So that was quite revolutionary then, you know, to be agreed to take your child to. So I was thrilled. So, of course, I did it. And my dear flatmates upstairs helped babysit in the evenings for me.
So what were you expecting from the role? I mean, it sounds to me like it was partly, it was a convenient thing for your career, keep your career going,
yes,
earn
it
money.
Was.
So yes. it wasn't this is the role you have to play then.
No. It was, no. I mean, I thought about it, I loved the idea, because just like Sally, I mean, we're a bit tomboyish and always were, you know, I climbed trees and thought the greatest thing was to play cowboys and Indians in the woods, you know, with my brother and sister. So it kind of rolled. It did suit all those things, really. It did suit. And I liked the idea. And it was just a new adventure. We're opening up a new adventure, but it wasn't terribly well paid in terms of the fact I was going to be financing a live-in nanny, which was the only way I could do it. But, you know, it was keeping the career going, and got very tired doing it because, of course, it was great, really, because, you know, when you're doing an episode, some episodes you're busy in, some you're a couple of days or something rehearsal. So I never felt I lost touch with my son's pattern of life. You know, some days I'd see him all day and then I go off to work for, you know, an hour in the afternoon or something. So, and it was for 10, how much long was it? It was for about 10, I can't remember, 7-8 months of the year for 3 years running. And then I'd have the rest of the time off. So it was an absolute godsend. And then the money popping through the posts when you just couldn't pay a bill in the later years was just brilliant.
So very much an ensemble cast. What were your first impressions? You knew Stephen Greif. You knew Michael Keating. Did you know anyone else beforehand?
Well,
what was
Gareth,
your impression when you met them?
Because Gareth was at the RADA at the same time as Stephen and I. He was in my finals production of St. Joan. He played the English soldier in that. So I knew him, not very, very closely or well, but yes, I knew him. And, I haven't told you do you want to know about the first time I set eyes on Jacqueline Pierce?
Yes, please.
Well, when I was part of the youth theatre, I made a good friend called Judith Smith, who she was a bit older than me, and she got a place at RADA. And so we were in close touch because she lived in South London, as I did. And she would talk about Anthony Hopkins, who was in her class, and Jacqueline Pierce. They were the two people she talked about an awful lot. She obviously really liked Anthony Hopkins and was obviously very impressed by Jacqueline Pierce, and who wouldn't be? And there was the day I went to meet her outside the steps of college. And of course she was then saying, there's Jacqueline Pierce. There's. And I saw the back, this long, glossy black hair down her back. And she was wearing what was very fashionable at the time. It was a grey flannel pleated skirt, so it was quite hip. And then I met her again when I went to a health spa when I was 21. It was after my dad died, and I had a bit of an eating disorder. I was very unhappy with having put some weight on, and I'd made some money doing one of the RSC jobs understudying, and I thought, well, I want to go to this what we called a health farm. It was more of a health farm than a spa, you know. They emphasized very good for rheumatism, things like that. And it was in a nice country house near Hazelmere in Surrey, and there were sort of cabins outside where one stayed, for it was like for 5 days, 6 days. There I met two girls. One was called Caroline Cater, who was also at RADA, and the other was Jacqueline Pierce. And so actually we'd sit drinking our grape juice in the evenings, having a giggle and a chat and things. So that was when I really did get to know her a bit, you know, rather than just hear about this beautiful girl. Yeah.
So when she finally appeared on the show, because that was about episodes 6 or 7 in, had you been expecting her to turn up, or she just turned up, and do friendships just renew automatically?
Well, I guess we knew early-ish on because we saw cast lists and things. But because of the nature, it's like that at the RSC. You've got the people who play the soldiers, and you've got the kings and queens. In Blake 7, it was us and the crew and them, the Federation. So in an odd way, that sort of, it gets a bit reflected in the relationships early on, because like Travis and Brian and Stephen and Jacqueline, Brian and Jacqueline were sort of closer than we were, or some of us anyway, because they were seeing each other so much more frequently. Yeah.
Yeah. And acting together and building those relationships.
Yeah.
So what about the rest of the cast? How what are your other impressions in terms of, you know, Sally or David, Mike, you mentioned?
I was very fond of dear David. What a lovely, kind, generous man. And very fond of all of us. We had a really good time. And yes, I became a close friend of Jacqueline until she died. I mean, these last years. And I am still a very close friend of Sally's. So those relationships have gone down the many years, because we've shared this experience together. And of course, we've gone on meeting up with the conventions we're invited on, and then in these later years doing the audios for Big Finish. So it's always an absolute delight, kept us together, but we become friends anyway. I mean, I saw Sally 2 weeks ago, and we'll be in touch again this week. So we keep in touch, close touch.
Did you have any idea when you started this role that 45 years later you'd still be playing the same character?
Just unbelievable, isn't it? I mean, it's incredible. I mean, I feel tremendously lucky to have had it there. And as I say, in those years after Blake 7, because it was another 18 months after Blake 7 finished, I couldn't get a telly for life or money. And my agent said, oh, they think they know what you do. And again, because, oh, it's a bit naff, you know, people look down on it. I don't know, maybe they didn't like it being popular. The BBC were never really kind at that point to things that were popular. Do you know what I mean? You didn't feel you were treasured in any way. It was all a bit meh.
So why do you think Blake 7 has endured so long?
No idea. You'll have to tell me. Who are these people that have gone and watching it? I'm not a sci-fi fan, so I don't know. I just think successful series have an ingredient, which I think is to do with obviously the writing. It goes without saying, but that can be very variable, and was very variable, and continues to be a bit variable. But I think when you've got characters sort of relating to one another and the relationships, you can tell the difference between a close-knit gang who are working on a project when it isn't a team. And I think it was a good team effort, I think.
Why do you think Terry Nation, when he created such a strong character, warrior woman type character. Why do you think he had such trouble writing for her?
What do you mean to do because of the women's role? You're talking about as women rather than as men.
Yeah.
But I think that's true. It was a reflection of the time. But I've met people who said, oh, it was great to see girls doing that. Emma Peel and then us. I mean, it was a movement forward. And I think we were part of that. And as you know, Sally and I did, well, we thought we were giving a, well, I thought I was giving an interview to some Belgian paper. And I said, oh, well, sometimes Sally and I do get a bit frustrated. It's a bit like we're left on the Liberator to make tea, when really all we want to do is get out of London, get a couple of days filming, whether it was Box Hill, didn't matter, a cave in the UK, whatever. It was just lovely getting out and doing some filming and staying in a nice hotel. So we'd get stuck on the Liberator, think, oh, they're going off filming and we're not. But the girls got left on the Liberator to make tea. And I'll never forget the morning when our producer, Dave Maloney, strode in on the Monday morning and gave us such a dirty look. Because that was an article that had been published in the News of the World with the most horrible pictures of Sally and I. I mean, if they were going to choose pictures, they're the ones we'd have said, oh, for goodness sake, don't publish those pictures. They look awful. Yeah. We didn't understand either until Sally nor I understood. It'd be good if you had a mentor before you did a series. Like they now have mentors on leaving drama school. I could have done with one then, would have been very helpful, because I didn't recognise that after a couple of episodes, you do have a kind of power and you could always go to the producer and say, look, next series when they're writing it, maybe one could expand, what about this, and give your own ideas to feed to the writers. We didn't know that. We learned that that was possible too late.
So it was really a time, a progressive, you're sort of in that progression at that stage.
It was part of, not a big grumble about it, but I think it was part of a movement forward.
Absolutely. Now, the third series, Series C, there's a lot of material in there for Callie. Now, we're going to ask you something specific. I don't know how you go with specific episodes, but Sarcophagus was an episode that you featured in very heavily. What did you and the rest of the cast think when you read that script? Do you remember anything about that?
Well, I mean, it was a real fantasy one by Tanith Lee, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, of course, I loved the idea, because anything that meant I could play a slightly different character, ooh, I was hungry for. So even like Children of Auron, you know, to be able to play something different was great. Yeah, I was thrilled. And I loved doing that. It was kind of a challenge.
I was actually going to ask about Children of Auron, because it's sort of a fan favourite. And it's a part where you got to play two roles, because you're getting to play your twin sister Zelda as well. What was it like technically? What was it like emotionally in terms of trying to play the twin roles and make them both work?
Well, I just wanted to, all I did was sort of look in the box of possibilities and decide I'd make her as different as I could think of to Callie.
It sounds like you were having a lovely time. Was it hard when people like Sally and Gareth left and David left?
Yeah, sorry they left, of course. Very sorry, because we had, as you probably know, we had contracts that we were tied to for two series, and the third was an option, you know, we could pick up or not. And it certainly suited me to continue and do a third. I ran out of steam at the end of that. Unfortunately, I really did run out of steam, and I knew that I wouldn't be able to do my best work if I continued to do a fourth. But so yes,
by running out of steam, you were just tired of the whole process.
No, ran out of steam, of enthusiasm, of wanting to do it, of enjoying doing it. I mean, you've got to communicate through playing a character in a group. You've got to want to do it. I mean, you've got to enjoy it, otherwise it won't be your best work. And I felt I'd run out, and I wanted to do other things, something else by then. Yeah.
How hard did they push you to come back?
Oh, they did. I mean, if I'd realised the fans would have been so upset with me, and having been at conventions and asked questions about it subsequently, I recognised, I think, God, if I thought people were that upset, I would have done another episode or even three just to do it exit properly. But I was just, they were saying, well, would you do 6 episodes? Would you do 3 episodes? Would you do 1 episode? Would you? I was like, no. And then it ended up just a voiceover. That was me sticking my, you know, putting my foot down, which I regret. I think I should have done it differently.
I can honestly say I was one of those people traumatized by Kelly's death.
When I'm sorry.
I was quite young, and when that fourth season started and it ends, you know, starts with you dying, I was just devastated. So
I'm sorry.
I've got over it now.
I'm so pleased to hear that. Good.
That opening scene still brings a tear to my eye. I'm not sure if you ever watched it either, because poor Daryl plays it really powerfully in terms of saying what's happened. And he talks about the fact that you've died, and his voice is expressionless and just, it's matter of fact. But he does this look away, which just says there's so much emotion there, but he can't possibly express it. So I'm not sure if you've ever seen the scene, but poor Daryl plays it. And it just breaks my heart every time, which is why we think there's romance there.
Yes.
So having left the show, what obviously it was hard to get typecast as a female hero, which is a bit hard. I believe you did 3 years for the Royal Shakespeare. Was that soon after that?
Oh, gosh, no. I mean, that was, I don't know what I did after that. I know I was out of work for about a year and a half. Then I finally got a lovely part as a barrister in something called Crown Court with an actor called Ken Cranham. He was the other barrister. We were sort of, I was the defence and he was the prosecution in a upsetting episode about cop death. And you, I don't know if you've seen this similar programme where there are members of the public or the jury. And they actually, you do the drama and the questioning and everything. Miriam Margolyes was a witness as well. And you do it as though it's in court. And then the jury make a decision whether the woman in the dock is guilty or not. Well, Ken Cranham kept coming out of character and making jokes. I decided the best way to win the case was to be really serious. So they absolutely believed I really was a lawyer. And when they came to think about it, they'd go, yeah, I think that. And we did. And I said to the girl I was defending, who was accused of murdering her little baby, we were going to go for a meal if I won, and we won the case. But that was me coming back. And then after that, I didn't work in the theatre, I don't think, for a while after that. I was waiting for tellies, and then I gradually got more and more tellies, Holby City and some of our Lovejoy. And I started working more and more in television again after this sort of hiatus after Blake 7.
Okay, so did you do the Royal Shakespeare Company, or have I got that wrong?
Yeah, I did that. I did two. I went there 4 times. I did it before Cali. Then I went there. I was there in when I was shared a flat with Louise Jameson in 1973. This was before Cali, 73 to 75. Then 77, I had Sam, 78, I did Cali. And then I didn't work there again until 94. I did 94, I worked there, 96, I worked there.
Okay, so you and Lou lived together for a while.
She's a great friend.
Right.
We once got lost in France together. We went shopping in the people carrier. And we both had our little boys and we were staying with other people. And our first morning there, we said, we'll go do the shopping. We'll go and do the shopping. I had my son was about 5. She had her 2 who were younger. And we said, we'll go shopping for the rest of the 9 people. We got in the people carrier and I said, have you got your passport? She said, yes, you got yours. I said, yes, you've got some money. Yes, I've got yours. Let's go, because there's mums, you know, Harris mums. So we took off and we went to do the shop. And we remembered hearing this place called Poobel or something. That's all we knew. We went off. We went to the near lovely village where they were bowling in the sunshine. It was this glorious. We stacked the back of the people carrier with wine and bread and cheese and food. And we set off. We didn't know where we lived. We didn't know where we were staying. And we just remembered this word poubel, which if you know any French, means the rubbish, means like the dustbin. So we were going around asking people, où est la poubelle? Well, they thought we probably meant the rubbish dump, someone, big rubbish dump. And, you know, we asked people who were working on the telephone wires, anyone we could see as we motored along. We went back to the town and went on every route out, a different route every time. And we really got lost. And it got to lunchtime. And I said, look, we really ought to make contact. They'll be worrying about us because they were left with a six-year-old, a three-year-old, and a, you know, Harry must have been about, Sam was about six, seven, Harry must have been about five, and Tom about three or two. We'd left these babies, these young children with them. All the others were somewhat older, teenagers and stuff. Anyway, Lou was very determined to try and find it herself. And I said, well, maybe you could phone your dad, because we decided his dad would know, her dad would have known where the friends had gone. Anyway, meantime, we stopped off. We had some wine and we broke into the bread and the cheese. And eventually she did ring. She rang her dad and we got the address and found our way back like 3 hours late. Of course, they were really cross with us because they thought something ghastly had happened to the two mothers and they were left with these kids. But no, she's a darling friend. And we had many parallels in our career. The RSC I met her at, she was understudying me at the RSC initially. And she stepped in when I dried once in Richard II, bless her heart. She could see, she just picked up the lines and said them. And she could see I'd got transfixed. She was brilliant when she did that, saved my bacon. And after that, yes, we shared her doing Leela, and then I got Callie, and then we both were single mums, and we both lived in North London. And there was a point at which we were going to buy a big mansion flat together, but I think my son had started school and I'd come out of the Rusks area. She was going to have Tom. And I said, look, Lou, I don't think I will. And I also thought, you know, give the dad a chance sort of thing. Anyway, I always felt guilty about that, but she thanked me about that. She said, you did so the right thing, because the dad of Tom became a very much part of the family, and dad to Harry as well.
Speaking of Lou Jameson, who was with Doctor Who and you in Blake 7, you never actually did get to appear in Doctor Who all those years. You haven't even appeared in Doctor Who in Big Finish like some of the other Blake 7 cast. But the closest you did get to Doctor Who was a Doctor Who crossover or spin-off, really, in the 90s called Shakedown, Return of the Sontarans. You had the lead role in that along with Brian Croucher. What memories do you have of that?
Oh, just I really enjoyed it. And I loved Kevin. It's Kevin, isn't it?
Yeah, that's
right. It was great fun. I enjoyed doing that. And I loved that character. I really liked that character. I could have gone a long way with her. I liked her. And I liked working with Brian because I hadn't really worked with him before. And I'd known him socially because I had a boyfriend when I was 23, Tom Marshall, and he and Brian, they all shared a flat. So I knew him then, and they were all at Lambda. So I kind of knew him sort of socially.
Were you aware at the time of how big a Doctor Who Blake 7 sort of crossover that was with actors from both sides?
Well, there wasn't so much. It sort of increased as time went by. Mind you, my son has done Doctor Who. He's done a couple of Doctor Who's for Big Finish.
What's his name?
Sam Woodward. You should find he did a couple, and John Ainsworth cast him the first one. He did our anniversary one, our 40th anniversary one.
He was the Way in Ahead, that, wasn't it?
Yes, and then afterwards he got cast in another one.
Philip's going to run us off a list of what he's been in.
I've got Colin Baker's Iron Bright.
Oh yeah.
And then I've got The Way Ahead. And then he was in the Blake 7 Rebellion Reborn, which isn't Big Finish.
Coming soon from Big Finish Productions, Blake 7, The Way Ahead.
Tell me about Blake, Villa. Tell me about Avalon.
All right, then. You might not like what you hear.
Ah, Travis.
Supreme Commander, welcome to your new battlecruiser.
Impressive. I hope this little experiment is worth it.
Avalon, what happened?
I can't... We were winning. The Federation was retreating.
Then what?
It happened so quickly.
You've been trying to kill us for a long time, Travis. We're still waiting for you to get it right.
Well, things are changing. Blake's crusade is coming to an end.
Yes, Avon. The Liberator is a weapon. A weapon you have chosen to squander. Senior figures in the Rebellion are dissatisfied with your activities in the aftermath of the war.
I didn't realize we were answerable to anyone.
We should retreat back to the base.
Too late.
This is a fine mess you've got us into, Avon. No guns, no Liberator, nothing.
How many times has it come to this? You and I, alone together.
I've never bothered to count.
And fate just can't keep us apart.
There she is.
Attack vector plotted. Here goes nothing.
Today we strike in the name of Rog Blake.
Big Finish. We love stories.
So how did you end up returning to the role of Callie for Big Finish? Do you remember that process?
I just got contacted by David Richardson, and they contacted, and so I thought, well, this will be great fun. And it was so strange the first days in the studio and seeing people I hadn't seen, like I hadn't seen Paul, I hadn't kept up any friendship with Paul or Gareth or Michael. It was Sally I'd seen and Jax, and it felt just like we were in the television studio again, really, because, of course, the group dynamics were exactly the same as I remembered, you know, and people were behaving to type, as it were. And it was lovely, really lovely.
I guess the scripts played a lot in that regard as well, because a lot of attention to detail with regard to the scripts, but a couple of different types of scripts, though. A couple of different types of stories for the Rangers, because you've got the Chronicle stories, which are more like half audio book with narration and things like that, with only a very small cast. Then you've got your full cast. Which do you prefer to play? Is there much of a difference for you, or you just go with?
Oh well, I found the ones where there are only a couple of regular characters, and you were sort of more reporting quite a lot of what happened. I like to think they worked really well, because they sort of felt doing them. You sort of felt you were doing them with everybody for some bizarre reason. You didn't feel aware of. I thought they were really well written in that respect, you know, and I hope they worked. But of course, one loved doing the full cast ones most of all, and also meeting lots of new people coming in to do stuff was good. Nice meeting the guest stars and guest people came in.
We recently reviewed a Liberator Chronicles, as those small cast audios were called. And I agree with you 100% that it doesn't feel like there's only one or two people there. It does feel very well fleshed out. And
I'm glad.
Combine those great scripts with your performances. And the one we were doing was called the Armageddon Storm. So there was one episode in particular with just you and Michael Keating, all set on a planet. I think they dropped Michael Keating's voice so he could play an extra character in it as well, some kind of terrorist leader or rebel leader. It was just really, really nicely fleshed out. It was beautiful to listen to. That whole Liberator Chronicle series is just full of gems, absolutely full of gems.
Happy to hear that. Really is.
It was actually your first role back, Jan, and you just fell into place perfectly with the others. So yeah, it's a great story, but then it progressed, of course, to a lot more depth after that. So you've done a lot of full cast now as well. So, and of course, there's sort of two different crews. So there's the crew with Sally and Gareth for the first two seasons. And then there's the one with Stephen Pacey. And of course, Paul and Michael and you cross over both areas. Yeah. So how have you found all the scripts? Do you tend to remember them, or do you go in, just do them and leave behind?
I mean... Nowadays, it gets harder to remember detail. I just know it's lovely when, you know, we have a change and Stephen's there and Yasmin's brilliant. She's lovely. Because she has something about her that reminds me of Josette, something to do with her intonation or her inflection, somehow, the way she does it. And she's such a darling girl. She's lovely to have around, I must say.
I mean, Yasmin is an amazing actress. Is it sad that Josette hasn't come back? Are you disappointed you haven't got to work with her again?
Well, no, it's peculiar because it's so long ago. It's like, you know, I remember I only did one series with her. I can only guess that somewhere along the line she got some negative feedback. Remember, she hadn't even finished her drama school course when she did that. And maybe she was critical of her own work in it and wasn't happy with it. But I mean, obviously, she has a very strong reason for not getting involved. I'm sad that she didn't.
Big Finish has started recasting some roles from the Doctor Who show because naturally, a number of actors have now passed. They're being a bit more creative in terms of what they're now doing with your characters. Would you be interested or not in terms of having recast of Blake Seven members, or are you much happier with what they're doing in terms of the new story?
I like what they're doing now because I think now they've got the confidence that people will still be interested and want to buy them. And it's got a commercial side to it because we have to remember that is obviously a big consideration. I think now after all this time, it seems to me it's right. And especially it's not like people decided, oh, they didn't want to do it anymore. They did actually die. I just think it's the right thing to move it on. And of course, you know, we've all got limited lives. So at least presumably they'll have created something different to move forward with. So I think it's absolutely the right decision and night and refreshing and good.
Mm. You've been enjoying the new stuff they've been giving you, like in the Clone Masters. Are you enjoying that sort of work?
I loved Laura. I loved, again, playing two characters, really. So I enjoyed doing that a lot. Yeah.
How did you record that? Did you go into studio for that or with lockdown were you recording?
I went into studio for that. Yes, I did, because everyone else has got home studios or were getting them. And because I'm kind of have a different lifestyle now, really, I do things. If people offer me things, I will think about it and do it. But I mean, they're not really, except a Big Finish. And I've moved on. I mean, I had a very solid career in teaching. I had to as a single mum, I couldn't afford to be out of work anytime. So I created and continued to build a strong teaching career. I also had a little business interest and rental property. And I decided a little while back now that I was going to not always put this business first. And I ran an agency too for my students, you know, an entertainment agency. And I started that back in 2008, which I don't do now. It doesn't function now, really. But I wanted to be free to go on the holiday, free to go to the party, free to go to the funeral, free to go to the wedding. And everything throughout your career, you're always putting everything else behind getting that job. And I'm free of that, and I don't have that compulsion that does make people stick with the business. The sense of somehow this sort of discontent, unhappiness, if you haven't got a job or nobody's offering you a job as an actor. It's like a disease, and it's terrific to be free of it. I mean, I feel I grew up somewhere alongside becoming an inspector of drama schools. And I think lots of things changed me on my route to doing other things. And I feel quite valuable doing other things now. I think one just doesn't feel quite valuable enough, which is what keeps people sort of urgently, even when you're really quite old, where's the next job? And of course, it's tragic, really, because of course, once you hit even your late 50s, 60s, as reflects real life out there, the actual proactive, fascinating jobs diminish. And I know a lot of actors who are older who are very frustrated now.
So with all that in mind, what's next? What's your next chapter for the next Jan Chapel chapter?
I understand there are some scripts being written for further Big Finish, and I'm looking forward to that. I'm really looking forward to that. Because I do love doing them. And of course, it's lovely keeping your your foot in the warm bath of, you know, Big Finish and doing the audios and seeing the chums on other actors. It's lovely. It's really lovely. And you always have a good time.
You seem to regain your voice immediately. Like, I mean, both the Cali voice is just still there in terms of, it doesn't sound like it's aged at all.
Doesn't it? Oh, I'm bad.
No, it sounds great. And also you just drop into character. Is it just that you've been playing the character for so long? Or is all your acting experiences just come straight back whenever you just hold the script in your hand?
Yes, it does. It just comes back. Cali just comes back. And it's the same. One still has the same instinct after, you know, whatever it was, 33 episodes. You still have this instinct that goes, John Ainsworth, John, excuse me. It's just weird she says that because it's not very Cali. You know, if something pops out, it just doesn't seem right. So, yeah, and so you get it corrected. So you're still like you were in, even when we were doing the TV, sometimes when you got to know the characters, something would pop out that you wanted to sort of script edit. Yeah. Yeah, it's under the skin.
Welcome, Lodge Blake.
What was that?
Stealth attack. The rebel fleet have arrived.
But what kind of ship?
It could only be one ship.
Destroy it! Destroy the Liberator!
Coming soon from Big Finish Productions.
Representative Ronte. Now this is a pleasant surprise.
Supreme Commander.
After everything that's happened, you can call me Servalan.
Servalan, what's on the lost freighter?
Still not worked it out.
The trial left out quite a bit of the story. Perhaps you could oblige me.
Does that matter now? There's no chance of appeal.
Your executioners are waiting.
I'm not dead yet.
Don't tempt me. Gunships to attack.
Battle speed.
Full power to drives.
Shields up.
Attack, go.
Full power.
This shuttle can't last much longer.
It's too late to reach the freighter now. Too late for anything.
Why did you ask to see us? What is your dream?
I want it to end. I want to know how to overthrow the Federation. I want to win. Now.
Very well.
Blake 7, The Liberator Chronicles.
To the victor, the spoils.
Volume 8.
Oh, Jenna. I've missed you, you know.
I know.
Why did you leave?
Well, there you go, Philip. Another check off your bucket list. Speaking with Jan Chappell there, how was that for you?
It was just wonderful. I mean, what a charming woman and great stories. And yeah, and unfortunately, people won't get to hear all her stories. Sorry about that, guys. But I'm sure you've enjoyed what you've heard.
You tease, Philip. It was absolutely fascinating. So at the time of recording, The Clone Masters is just about to come out, but it will definitely be out by the time you hear this. So drop in the comments or send us some feedback on your thoughts on The Clone Masters, because that's certainly a release that we're highly anticipating, isn't it, Phil?
It is indeed. And it's a good thing it'll be out by the time we release this, because she did drop a couple of spoilers in there, which was, you all know about now because you've listened to it, so it's not a problem. But I wasn't going to stop her, because you don't stop a guest when they're mid-spoiling.
Absolutely not. There's more Worlds of Blake 7 coming too. So with the Blake 7 range, with Space 1999, with some new Survivors coming out, they're certainly really going hard with the non-Doctor Who releases is Big Finish. And I think there's a really, really exciting releases coming up across the board, Philip.
Indeed there are.
So let's go into some of our recommendations, and let me just check, because it could be your turn, Philip. What have you got to recommend for us?
I'm going to recommend a little bit of a series. I've had a bit of a burn in the last week on Torchwood, because a lot of the Torchwood stories I'd not got to with other things we were listening to, and I had a bit of time on my hand this week and just decided I'd do a bit of a Torchwood burn.
So as in Bern Gorman?
Actually, he's not in any of them.
Oh.
So the three I've listened to in the last 3 days, so I've had 3 in 3 days, was Curios, was the first one. And then I've also listened to The Empire of Shadows and Madam I'm. Three most recent, and I'm not sure any more would have been released by the time you hear this. All three are interesting because none of them have any of the main Torchwood cast. I mean, Melvin, so the character in Curio's Billis was a baddie who appeared in a couple of episodes of Torchwood. And then they've brought back from a Doctor Who show. Is it Sean Parker? That's what I've got in my top off my head. Yes, the actor Sean Parker, who played the commander of the base with the Ood in those double episodes in the second season, which are just amazing episodes. And he mentions the fact he works for the Torchwood Archive. And so he's come back as his role as the Torchwood Archive. And then Madam Imes,
Samuel Barnett, actually.
Yeah, Samuel Barnett. Excellent. And it's also got Dervan Kiran in it, who's the woman in red in the next Doctor special. So it's three very different stories. So one set in the 1950s, 60s, one set in the far future, one set during the First World War. I think they're all by James Goss, actually. It's just amazing styles. So there's humour. The Curious one today is actually very unnerving and very uncomfortable, and it deals with some uncomfortable issues. It really isn't for children. Not like Torchwood. And there's a couple of moments where it's very, very bleak. And so that is a James Goss, and yet it hasn't got his humour. One of the things that James Goss is often great with is his humour, but that's certainly not the case with the Curios. Madam I'm, though, is hilarious. And Madam I'm also has brought back another Torchwood character. So one of the characters, I won't spoil it, but, Brian Dick has returned as that role. But that's just hilarious. And it's actually scene after scene a little bit of spoilers, lots of memory wiping happening. And so replaying scenes and progress. So that's a character called Adam, who was in the original show. And then the future one is all set, look at the Empire. Just James, and that's also, just confirming, I'm pretty sure that's also James Goss. These two, so that's three in a row he's written, but totally different styles, from total comedy, from Madam I'm, to freaky out, I'm scared as, in Curios, and then a sort of action-adventure in the Empire one. I love how James Goss writes. I love how he can just change styles, and I just love how, once again, Torchwood is able to play around with themes and always produce something entertaining. So if you want to be heavily entertained, those Torchwood one-hour stories, they're brilliant. What about you, Dwayne? What have you been listening to?
Okay, well, at the time of recording, we recently put the call out to our listeners for suggestions on things we should review, because we've been having our regular monthly Randomoid Selectatron pick. Last time we put it out to the audience, and so they picked a whole heap of titles, and we drew out Sapphire and Steel. So I've recently dug out my Sapphire and Steel CDs. So I've been busy ripping all those to my hard drive so I can put them on my phone when we actually pick the stories we're going to listen to. But I've also been re-listening to the very first release of Sapphire and Steel, which is called The Passenger, written by Steve Lyon. And I absolutely adore Sapphire and Steel, but I find it's one of those shows and formats that I have to find myself to be in the right mood for. Mind you, Susanna Harker and David Warner as Sapphire and Steel are just incredible. So very, very listenable. And although it's not completely different from the TV series, it's still got the same format. There's a different dynamic which makes it the same, yet something new at the same time. So it's not just a simple recast. They bring their own stuff to it, because I think Joanna Lumley and David McCallum are pretty irreplaceable as Sapphire and Steel. I think there was a point there where they were going to get them into Big Finish, and then for some reason they couldn't. So I've been re-listening to that. Now, I am recommending it, but it is difficult to get hold of. I would suggest that you go and try and find these CDs online. I think you can find them on eBay. Obviously, because Big Finish doesn't have the license anymore. By the time this episode comes out, we may have already done our review of the two stories that our audience has picked. At the moment on the poll, we've got Joseph Lidster's Daisy Chain and John Dorney's Remember Me, two great authors for the range on top of that list. So we may listen to those unless the poll changes. I kind of hope it doesn't, because I wanted at least one of Joe Lister's stories, and John Dorney was another one I had my eye on too. So keen to have a look at those. But yeah, Sapphire and Steel, anything from the range, but I've been listening to the very first one called The Passenger.
Okay, fantastic.
What are your thoughts on Sapphire and Steel? Because I don't think you've ever really got right into it, have you, Philip?
I watched a few episodes of the TV show and I found it pretty slow, and I got sort of dulled out by it and stopped watching. So I don't think I got past. So I watched all the first story, which was about six episodes, and I was probably started the second one and thought it's not getting any faster, and I just never got back to it. And although I've got all them audio stories, I've not listened to them yet. So I need to have a listen. But I mean, Susanna Harker and Dave Warner, two sensational actors.
Yeah.
So I do need to have a listen to it. I want to hear. And I think that's how, is that how Dave Warner joined Big Finish, or had he started with other things first?
I really don't remember. It was 2005. So he may have, by that stage, already done The Unbound. I would say The Unbound episode that he was in would have come out. So that was probably his first one.
Okay. Well, we'll do some research before we release these, so we'll know.
Very good. All right, that'll do us for this time. Thank you, Philip, for joining me once again. I'm sure it was awfully difficult for you today.
It was a struggle, that's for sure.
All right, until next time, catch you later. Toodaloo.
Bye.
This has been the Sirens of Audio, Episode 80, Read My Mind, with our special guest, Jan Chappell, and your hosts, Philip Edney and Dwayne Bunny. Theme music by the Jackpot Golden Boys. Our email address is sirensofaudio@gmail.com. Be sure to subscribe to us on YouTube and your favourite podcast app. You can find links to all our socials and lots of other info at sirensofaudio.com. And when you need a Doctor Who audio detox, simply throw on some Blake 7 audio drama. Your ears will love you for it. Because audio drama... Rawr!